You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Fork in the road. There's not someone telling you that you should take this one and not that one. Instead, what you've got is a full congregation and a community behind you, encouraging you to take whatever fork you think you need to take on your own personal spiritual journey. If you've found lately or recently that you've undergone a transformation in your spiritual life and you wish to mark that occasion, we invite you to tie a ribbon on the tree of transformation, which is sort of this vine you see on the back wall there, and there are ribbons in a basket. We're big on ritual and symbolism here at West Hill, and that's just one way that we like to exemplify that. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. Each week, in order to remain aware of our treaty obligations and the relationship that we have with our First Nations sisters and brothers, we read one of the 94 recommendations sent to all levels of government by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We expect to complete these readings in June 2017, and we're on recommendation number 64 right now. We call upon all levels of government that provide public funds to denominational schools to require such schools to provide education on comparative religious studies, which must include a segment on Aboriginal spiritual beliefs and practices, developed in cooperation with Aboriginal elders.
Grounded, guided, growing. A time for centering. From Scott Kearns.
I imagine there were many, many people this week, and that could have been the week before and the week before, that turned on a television or a computer and felt the ground shaking under them because the world as they either knew or hoped for had changed, and or it wasn't what they had wished for, and that at the high level of governments and the small level of communities and in people's individual lives. And that's when we talk about grounding ourselves. What is it that we ground ourselves in, ground as our foundation that we know does not move and that we walk upon? And there's so many things we think are solid and they end up not to be. And so we come down to that very basic thing here, to ground ourselves in the reality of life, which includes those things that shake us and those things that delight us. And we stand together on that ground of life and we ask the question continually, how should we live? And that's simply all we really do here, is to remind ourselves to choose, to keep choosing, to keep figuring out how to love, how to care, how to show compassion, how to demonstrate that we believe in justice. And I need you and you need me, because you're wiser than me and I'm wiser than you in something. So we share that together humbly and gratefully and with a spirit of learning. And of course, a spirit of learning requires that you admit you don't know something, which is the hardest part of learning. But it's a beautiful thing to do that together.
We have readings today. First one is from David Foster Wallace, a man whose life was mapped out and that ends in the wrong destination, it is said. He was an exemplary fellow, grade A student, played on all the team sports, published works, wrote essays providing the best feel anywhere of what it means to be alive in the contemporary world. To the outside world, he seemed to have it all, but he struggled with his own personal demons that we cannot know, and in 2008, he hanged himself at the age of 46. He writes, "It now lately sometimes seemed a black miracle to me that people could actually care deeply about a subject or pursuit and could go on caring this way for years on end, could dedicate their entire lives to it. It seemed admirable and at the same time pathetic. We are all dying to give our lives away to something, maybe, offered as wisdom for the journey.
And I came across the, before we do that, I came across the ending of that reading, so I'm going to add to it. We are all dying to give our lives away to something, maybe, God or Satan, politics or grammar, topology or philately. The object seemed incidental to this will to give oneself away utterly, to games or needles, to some other person, something pathetic about it. A flight from in the form of a plunging into. Offered as wisdom for the journey.
Thank you. That was rousing. Rochelle Goodrich is a scholar and an author. Her quotes have been published in such books as Chicken Soup for the Soul, and her work has been used in philosophy courses and humanist courses. She has a strong love of the arts, drama, choir, sketching, painting, and literature. She writes, "Don't quit. When your last efforts fail, don't quit. When your performance is scoffed and ridiculed, don't quit. When you're told you have no talent, don't quit. When you come in dead last, don't quit. When it seems an uphill fight just to keep going, don't quit. When you can't see any possible way to achieve your goals, don't quit. When your last supporter is you alone, don't quit. When discouragement and depression seem your constant companion, don't quit. When you feel like quitting, don't quit. Time and again, you will crave relief from the harsh fight of trying to succeed. You will falsely think, perhaps, that quitting will bring peace and reprieve. But alas, only regret and disappointment await the quitter. Victory means never, ever, ever quitting. So, don't quit. Do not quit." Offered as wisdom for the journey.
Very good. You did it beautifully. I need a second page here.
Focused Moments from Greta Bosper.
The Focused Moment is written each week, given the theme of the service, but it got tainted a little bit by the happenings of the week, and so it reflects the theme, but also the realities that have unfolded in the world this week. Don't you get it? There is no happy medium. No place where we can all sit down and talk about our troubles, eager to find a solution for everyone. There is no great court where we can lay it all out there to collectively assess the damage, point to and pick up broken fragments that we once thought were whole, and paste them back together, or smooth the smudges of weathered dreams into some coherent whole. There never was. Reality is tricky like that. It takes your perspective and casts the world in its own particular glow, everything seen and measured from a vantage point no one else can share. It bleeds the world of every other color, leaving it decidedly your own, even if you're trying very, very hard to see the breadth of the whole damned mess even if you've done everything you can to try to understand it all. You simply can't. But answer me this. When was the last time can't was the last word for you? When was never, or not now, or forget it, solution enough? When was it last normal for you to not look back on tragedy or the detritus of anger, the bloodied remnants of prejudice, the disaster of hate? When was it last you turned and walked away uncaring? We have our world before us. Its wounds of hatred seep. Anger's fist is clenched and poised for action. Fear has won. Yes, it has. As it has done a million, million times before. And as a billion, billion times now past, we will arise, dress the wounds, search out the hidden fractures, and work our evolutionary way forward. Empathy, care, love, understanding. Refusing can't, as we have never done before. So when we were doing the taps and reveille, or reveille, however it's pronounced, Jean, how is it pronounced? Reveille. Okay, she just doesn't say it. Okay, that's fine. All right. But I was thinking of taps. I was thinking of Susan B. Anthony and that lineup of people that went there on Tuesday. And how they felt early, early Wednesday morning when that gesture they had undertaken to go and put those stickers on her grave, the woman who allowed for women to vote, and the women who were looking forward to this historic moment and the defeat that they felt as a group on Wednesday morning. That's what I was hearing, experiencing when that horn was blowing the loss of a comrade who has made our strength stronger. And then there's that 2 minutes of silence, and what happens after that? We're called to service. We're called, that horn gets going, and it says, you can't stay down there. You've got to come back up. You've got to rise again in our hearts, in our homes, in our communities. You've got to rise again with whatever that promise was that you poured your life out for. And if you can't get up, we'll carry that for you. We do this over and over again in our lives. So that's what I heard when that music was playing this morning. And when I went over and placed a ribbon on the prayer frame, it was purple. Those of you who will remember when I used to gown, I used to have a purple gown. I struggled, you know, I really loved the academics of theological college, so I was going to wear a Geneva gown, which is the classical black scholar's garment, and that's what I was going to wear when I got ordained. I thought that was who I was. But when I tried one on, you know, they come to the college with all these different things, and I tried this thing on, and, well, no. Completely masked who I was, completely masked the fact that I was heading into ministry as a woman. So I decided I was going to go for the alb thing, you know, that long flowing robe. And I was going to have it purple because of the suffragette movement, because of the hard win that women's recognition as a person was in this country not that long ago. So I wore this purple alb for the first many years of my ministry. I wore it one time to the installation of a local minister at the Lutheran church, and And the Anglican came up to me and said, well, that's rather presumptuous, isn't it? Because, of course, purple is a bishop color in the Anglican Church. Hey, I thought, what, am I not a woman? So I wore that with pride. I don't wear it now. It ended up in my closet filled with moth holes. But we took it and got it dry cleaned anyway because we want to keep it to remind us of all we have been through. So each week, many of you know that I look at the readings that are scheduled in the lectionary for the coming year, not this year, but for next year, in the hopes that I could get together enough resources that people can actually use the stuff that we create here for their own services in a post-theistic way, whether or not they want to identify as non-theists or post-theists or atheists, if they're ministers in a church, and they want to use resources like that, I'll have them ready for them. So I usually read the readings, and then I pick a theme out of them, and I dance with that theme throughout the week until we have our service here. And rarely do I bring those readings into the service. I don't usually include them in the readings unless I've rewritten them in some way or revisioned them in a contemporary setting. But when I read them this week, it was Wednesday. Wednesday's the day that I prepare for Sunday. So it was Wednesday after weeping and understanding and weeping and not understanding and weeping again, I went to the readings. And so I'm bringing them in today. Because the readings were reminding us of God's past and challenging us, you know, do you want to serve those gods? Are those the gods that you want to give your life to, that you want to show your solidarity with? Are those the gods that are going to care for you? So I thought that we could look at some of those classical gods and what they offered us. And when I started looking through them, I went first to Greek and Roman gods. Did I tell you that when I was in grade 9, I told my mother I was going to believe in the Greek and Roman gods? Well, they made more sense, really. I mean, they touched on so many things that were, you know, important to me. So I told my mom I was going to believe in them, and she told me I had to believe in her God till I was 16, which is about how long it lasted. But then I got to theological college, and having discussed this with my grade 9 English teacher, and her husband was my systematics theology professor. So I quickly, you know, towed the line there and studied everything I was to study, all of which pointed me in a non-theistic direction, but anyway. But when I look back at those gods, I started to, what were they doing? Like, what were those gods for? I mean, they each had different attributes. They each addressed a particular part of life. But when I started to sift through them, I saw that really they answered our most urgent fears. There were gods that answered our fear of hunger. You know, they were going to provide us food. They were going to set it before us. They were going to teach us how to make wine and care for our crops. They were going to be present in the earth as we tilled the soil. The gods addressed our fear of hunger. And they addressed our fear of extinction. You know, that was a big one. Fertility has been the realm of the gods through all of human history. And as long as we were fertile, we would not be extinct. And so they filled that function. And the fear of death, they made that underworld. They gave us where we would go. They fulfilled that fear. Or they fulfilled the function of addressing that fear and making us feel more confident. And then they also challenged us with that fear of getting slaughtered in war. A lot of the gods are pictured with, you know, all kinds of weaponry and shields and things like that, because we could call on them in a time of war and they would be present with us. So they answered all those kind of primal fears that we had. So once I had kind of sorted that out, I went and I thought, well, where in contemporary understanding and knowledge do we deal with these kinds of fears? I mean, aside from, you know, some of the gods that still hang around, where else do we recognize that those are important in it? And I thought about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And you know the triangle, it's a pretty basic triangle. It's broken into different sections, and the bottom one, it's talking about what needs we have to meet before we can go on and, you know, achieve other things or think about other things. And just as the gods met all those needs, once they were met, once we had confidence in them that they would be present to us, then we could move on and think about other things, pleasure and entertainment and enjoying, love making rather than just fertility issues. We could get beyond some of those other things. But the first one in Maslow's hierarchy is physiological needs. And those are the ones that the gods addressed in many ways. We need sleep and rest. We need food. We need shelter. Those are the basic things. And if we don't get those things, then we're hardly able to do anything else. We're hardly able to get on to the next things of life. We're hardly able to see beyond the next meal, beyond the next night, beyond the next quest for some shelter. Millions and millions and millions of people have been reduced to this in the last few years in the world as the refugees, economic and conflict refugees, grow in number in this world, and it staggers to try to accommodate them. But how many are now stuck in that attempt to find a way to fill their physiological needs? The next level is, what's the next level, Scott? It's not fair to you. I only printed out half my sermon.
Romance.
Seriously. Honestly, that man. Romance. I think the next need, one of the next needs is shelter, but that's a basic need. And then there is, what's the next one? Yeah, belonging is up there. Social. This is terrible. Anyway, there's another one there. And then we get to belonging. I think it's belonging. I think it's love and social support. And then belonging and esteem. So belonging is one that religion has helped us figure out over the past while as well. And then esteem is one that we develop as our other needs are met. So as we have a sense of belonging, as we feel that we are loved and cared for, that empathy, which is so crucial in the first year of life, that it swells around us and wraps us in that understanding. And then we get to esteem. And once we have a good sense of esteem, then we can get to that self-actualization place. So I looked at the triangle, and I looked at these lists of needs that the gods have filled, and I wondered how the two combined. Like, how do we live in the world when all of those senses are filled and we're at the self-actualization place? What do we do with religion? What do we do with these religions which have been built to feed these very primal needs, to support us in our quest for these primal things? And I think that what it does is we then celebrate our esteem and our sense of belonging. Those are the two that religion really highlights for us once we have all our other needs met. I'm not suggesting that fear of death is one that is completely met by people who believe or don't believe. That's a constant human challenge to understand death and what happens when we die and what happens to those people we have loved who are no longer here. And Wei last week read a reading that spoke of our profound response to death, which is, I get it, but I don't accept it. But when we have religions and they become strong and they live on perhaps past their best before date, they serve almost exclusively to define us in groups. That was one of their really important things as they were developing, beyond just beliefs in gods, but to recognitions of particular religions. Identifying us as belonging to a group was very, very important. It sometimes kept us very safe in situations where we could identify who was like us, who dressed like us, and so they were then a part of our religious group, and we could trust them and know that they would shelter us, or who was buying certain kinds of food and who was rejecting something else and who spoke a certain language. That identified the religious group for us, and our sense of belonging was very, very important, and it held us. But now, when religion identifies that sense of belonging too strongly and builds a sense of self-esteem beyond a healthy narcissistic reality, and by that I mean we have to care for ourselves. We have to be attentive to our own needs. We can't just ignore them. And a healthy sense of a healthy narcissistic sense includes recognizing and understanding the needs of others. It grows into that sort of perverted sense when that last part falls off the scale. When our attentiveness to others becomes overshadowed by our own particular needs, by our desire to have everything in the world focus on us, by our having other people, as I often see it, shining those white, you know, those white screens that they use. If you ever see somebody doing a, filming a commercial or something, and there's someone down there with a white screen making that person look great, that's what a narcissist expects. You're all going to just shine that white screen. And I fear that religion has become complicit in that, because it has, in many cases, hardened into this self-esteem and belonging reality. So those are the gods of our past. And the reading asks, the lectionary reading for next year's week this week, asks, you know, all of those gods are out there. They're all there. And you can follow any of them if you want. And then it goes on and says, but as for me and my house, this is the God we're going to serve. So there's my question to you today. What God are we going to serve? What is it that we will lay our lives down for? What is it that if we had to give up our very last breath, we would give it in service of that? What is the God that we follow that brings us into this place and coheres us as a community and inspires us beyond this place to be in the world in a different way? As for me and my house, we will serve love. That's what I consider the God of now. Not those other ones that play to my fears. Not those other ones that suggest that I don't need to want anything. But that God that challenges me to want more of that. More love in this world. This week has been a particularly difficult week for love. We've seen it rise and fall. And we've seen it rise again and fall. And I don't think we've ever had a week, actually, in our lives that love hasn't risen and fallen in exactly the same way somewhere. We're just privileged that we have a perspective that's North American. So we aren't fighting for all those basic needs. And we aren't living in a society that makes our very being illegal sometimes. We aren't in that. We have the privilege of anesthetizing ourselves to what it is that is nice, to what it is that can entertain us for another couple of hours, for what it is that can, you know, remind us that it's a beautiful world. But for many people, and for many people in the United States right now, many identifiable groups and many others, it's not so easy to find love right now. I mean, we can encourage people to gather into groups and share that, but there's a lot of anger and hatred out there, and it often gets to the point that you don't know what the possibilities are. You don't know what you can do. You don't know what to hang on to when everything seems to change, to fall down all at once. And I think that we have watched an enormous cascade of love end up in a heap on the floor this past week. But this past week, I also was speaking to someone about getting to that place where you don't have the confidence to go forward, where you're afraid of what the next minute might bring, where the world or the reality you're existing in is one that stops you in fear. And we talked for a while, and I learned that there was, in this person's repertoire, one thing that could be held on to, one thing that you could believe in. And if in that moment of loss and that moment of fear, we were able to find one thing that we could believe in, that could help us cycle again back and lift love up and lift possibility and hope and see what we might be able to create in the future. I learned that. And so when you came in today, you each got a card. And I know that each of you, if you got to that place, and for some of you it's remote, I know, but I don't think it would take you far or much time this week to get yourself to the place where you can imagine nothing but fear, nothing but the absence of what has nourished you, nothing but a blank when it comes to looking at the future. And if you can imagine that, I want you to take that card and write down on it the one thing that you could believe in. What is one thing that you could believe in given that moment, given that sense of despair that has been fed this week? What is one thing you can believe in? I want you to write it down on that card. Because in our work, we run into that all the time. And you and your one thing are going to be the answer for someone. So I'm going to give you a minute to write that down. For those of you who don't have cards, there's lots of cards out in the back, and if you just write something down on a piece of paper, you can transfer it later. When we get past all those low parts on the Maslow's hierarchy, and we get past all those gods of our every need, and we get to that self-actualized place, or that place of self-actualization where we start looking for it, it's very tempting to go out and find stuff that makes us feel good. It's very tempting to do all kinds of personal reflection and spiritual growth and engagement. But I think that Maslow, back when he first drew that triangle back in the 1940s, I think he would have wanted us to not assume that that triangle sort of floated off on its own. I think he would have looked at us who live with extraordinary privilege, and he would have said, don't forget There's a whole big triangle underneath you. There's a whole lot of people. I think we've forgotten that. And I think that this last week is an indication of that. That the needs that are there, that have yet to be expressed until a ballot box hit them on Tuesday, that we've blinkered ourselves to that. So when we go forward, when we look for what it is that we can do, when we seek that evolutionary way through, that may take more thinking and more empathy and more compassion and more commitment and, God knows, more time. Maybe next time we'll remember that everybody's still there. There's so many people still there. And we'll be far more connected than we have ever been before. And perhaps, that will be the one thing that we can believe in. That when we are that connected, we will be able to make that difference that we need to make. I don't want you to go home with those cards. They're going to stay here in the office. And we're going to mail them out when somebody needs one more thing to believe in. Maybe only one thing. We're going to mail them out with that one thing that you believe in. And it's going to end up in somebody's mailbox and in somebody's heart. And it might make all the difference in the world. Thank you. The second level is safety. We have a tribute coming up now, and those of you who are wearing poppies, if any of you are, I invite you to come up and place them on our cloth here as that tribute is playing.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah. me ill. All I ever learned from love is how to shoot at someone who outdrew you. But it's not a cry that you hear tonight. It's not some pilgrim who claims to have seen the light. No, it's a cold and it's a very
you.
I can add to that, excepting to remind you that the world you go out into is a broken world. It's a tired world and it's a sad world. And it's a world in which so many people live without what it is that you and I share, that we know that we have the comforts that we can call our own and live confident of. And you are its light. You are the light that goes out into this world and makes it a different place, that lifts up all that shame and sorrow and lament and loves it into possibility, loves it into newness. It's you. And so you've got to go and do that because we're counting on you. So go from this place in love.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.